Thank you, Leah. Hi, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's a pleasure to be here tonight. I was a little surprised when the committee asked me to come out and do a two-hour talk on the traditions, but if that's what they want. Only kidding. Anyway, it's just been wonderful to listen to all the talent that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm sure, like anybody else, that you know, when you were drinking, you thought the only time you had talent was when you were drinking. And if you ever sobered up, you'd lose it all. And as you can see tonight, that boy, it's even better, and it's truer, and it really has reality in it. And God, it's just so beautiful to be part of this. I was thinking that, you know, when you have a musical theme and the musical event like this, when you look at the eighth step, Bill writes in the 12 and 12 about one of the great lessons of making the list of the people we'd harm, learning what harm is, that we learn a lot about ourselves, and he says, we then are able to live in harmony with our fellow human beings. And of course, that's the essence of all the music that was played, is the being in harmony. And as a practicing alcoholic, self-centered, if you wanted to use the music term, there was a song in World War II called Poor Johnny One Note. I'm sure nobody's old enough to remember that song, but it was a popular song, and this guy was having a problem getting a job as a musician because he could only play one note. And it was sort of a plaintive note, and they would just do that in the song. You'd just go, poor Johnny One Note, beep, and there'd just be that note. He just wasn't able to get a job. And I was thinking about us as self-centered alcoholics. We only knew one note. Me. It wasn't do, re, la, ti, do. It was me. And wherever we went, that was the only note we played. We just went up and we just said, okay, I'm here. Let me tell you about me. And I really thought when people said in relationships that I had a communication problem, I would go, well, maybe I do. Maybe I didn't tell her enough about me. So I would go back and re-explain myself in more detail who the real me was so that you could get in harmony with me. And now we come in here, and the suggestion is that we become the flexible one and adjust and get in harmony with the environment and with the people around us. And to carry the analogy a little bit further, in order to have good music, somebody has to write it. So we have to find out who is the master writer if the humans, if us, are all going to be in harmony. And, of course, it's our higher power. And if we were staying in touch with our higher power, praying only for knowledge of his score for us and the power to carry that out, it would automatically be in harmony. And that's the beauty of a spiritual program. It enables, and you just see that in AA all over the place, with one exception, the business meetings. It goes away there. All of the spiritual giants who were commenting during the regular meeting are at each other's throats because someone wants to have decaf coffee. But except for business meetings, I think we do live in harmony with each other. And it's because we're willing to change and to change our ideas and see when something's wrong, let's get rid of it. And it's just so nice to see how much more comfortable we are when we're not locked in to a stupid game plan for living that we assembled by the time we were 10. And we're not going to change it because we thought it up. And that's how I felt. You know, no, this is me. I understand a lot of stuff I do is really stupid, but it's mine. And I'm going to stay with it. And it was just so freeing to get rid of stupid ideas. Now, I didn't make that word up. Stupid is in the big book in quite a few places. Some of us go to psychiatrists and some of us go here. We got these terrible problems. And Bill says, yeah, but basically they're just stupid. And your ideas about that are stupid. And you ought to get rid of them and try something different. And so I just throw that out as there is simple answers to a lot of complex problems. But I didn't want there to be simple answers. I remember when I was locked up in the nut ward, at the end of my drinking, I was there for 6 months. And they would have group therapy sessions. This is back before they had alcohol treatment centers, and they had all of us in together, the drunks and the nuts. And every so often, mostly they talk about the other people's illnesses, manic depressive and suicides and schizophrenia or whatever all the other people had, and they'd be talking about these things and the psychiatrist would be leading the group. But every so often they would go, well, you know, we better have one meeting a month where we talk about the alcoholics. So they would go, well, today we're going to discuss the alcoholics problems. And the crazy people, and you can see why they were locked up, they would turn to us. There was only three of us in there, and there's about 30 other guys with there that were crazy. And they would turn to us and they would say, what you guys ought to do is stop drinking. And I remember saying to myself, no wonder they're locked up in here. That couldn't be the answer to my problem. That is too simple. My problems are much more complex than that. And I really believed it. There was all these other issues. I had six kids. I was getting thrown out of the Marine Corps. They took away my flying status. They were just picking on me, and I had these health problems. I had just went on and on. And here's these crazy people telling me I ought to just stop drinking. Of course, the next time I heard that was from my sponsor. I hate to spend too much time on my story, so I'm going to try to highlight it in 10 minutes, and then I like talking about recovery and AA and all the fun things we have in here. But very briefly, I grew up in Connecticut. I got one sister in the 30s. I got one sister. She's got 28 years in AA now. I didn't know she drank. I didn't know anything about that until she came in. And from the time I arrived in this family, my mother, my father, me, and my sister, I felt like I didn't belong. The four of us would be sitting at the dinner table, and I would be going, I got to get out of here. You know what I mean? I always didn't belong where I was, and I have no idea where that came from. We went to the Catholic Church, and the nuns and the ritual and the Latin and all the smells and all that stuff scared me to death. My sister loves it. She thought it was the friendliest place in the world. She just thought the nuns were cute. I thought they were Nazis and were scaring me, you know, so... You can see that it's a question of perception. This is what I saw. It wasn't what was really happening. And they're telling me about this loving God, and all those stuff. And I was 9 or 8, somewhere like that. And I was sitting in the front pew, and I was staring at the crucifix. And the crucifix in that church was a 20-foot wooden cross hanging from the ceiling. You could not miss it. And I'm looking at it, and it was almost like it spoke to me. It was like a spiritual awakening. And it said, little boy, do you see this crucifix? Yeah. Well, little boy, this is what God did to his only son that he loved. Guess what he's going to do to you. Now, that isn't what the church taught, but that's what I got. You follow what I'm saying? I had a special insight into the truth about God, and I fainted, and they carried me out. It was just like, So my relationship with God was not a comfortable one. It wasn't anything. I always felt guilty and wrong and, you know, just all the things that were piling up. So I had that little background. I was a good athlete. I was a good student, so I got high grades. They had a polio epidemic. I was out of commission for a year with a completely paralyzed leg and arm, but the Sister Kenny treatment saved a small percentage of us, and I got almost all the use of that back. But it was a scary thing because when you have these epidemics, they just grab you out of your house and then nobody can visit you and you're not really sure what's going on. You know, part of me said, I guess they were tired of me and the family. You know, it was some of those things. But anyway, I made it out of there, went to a little prep school, got very high grades. It was a pipeline right in New Haven, Connecticut, Yale University. Went down there. And then I met all the guys from around the country, and they were all rich, good-looking, and they all were smart, and they all knew what was going on, and they all had confidence, and I didn't. And I hated being in that environment because I was a misfit. I didn't belong in there. It was just awful, the pressure to be in there. And I knew during the freshman year that the dean of the freshman class was going to call all 1,000 of us out onto the old campus, and he was going to say, gentlemen, there is an imposter in our midst, and he's right over there. And they were going to point at me, and then I was finally going to be taken out of there because I certainly didn't belong. And that was how I felt. Now, I hadn't started drinking yet. And my roommates are going, you're 19 years old. You haven't had a drink. You're in college. And I said, no. I think it was something about the church, and you got 250,000 years off of purgatory if you didn't drink until you drank until you were 21. There was some very bizarre reason that I wasn't drinking. But I went to a social event one night where 30 guys are supposed to introduce each other. You know how that is? You just know, your names were on a list. Go in this room, just say, hi, 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 learn their names. Well, this terrified me. I still have a heart problem with that. But I tried that night. I remember going over and I said, I'm going to go up and I'm going to introduce myself. I'm going over. And I got there late and they'd all divided up into the groups, 5, 6, 3, 2. And I started over to the first group and all of them turned and looked at me and gave me the eye signal. Remember the eye signal? And they said, we don't want you in this group. We have enough friends. Go away. They didn't say that, but I could see it in their eyes. So I made an abrupt turn and went over to this group. And they saw me coming and they turned and glared and said, we don't want you in this group either. So I went back to that group and that group. And I never did meet anyone because of the hostility and the insecurity that I felt in that room. And I hadn't said a word. Now, there was a bar in that room. And so I said, God, my roommate said, alcohol makes you feel good. I think I'll go have a drink. I went up and ordered something, scotch and soda, whiskey and soda, something like that. It tasted awful. I said, I can't believe people are drinking this stuff. I'm just sort of standing there. I drank it. Nothing happens. I said, it doesn't make you feel good. Maybe I'll have another one. Had the second one. It didn't make me feel good. So I said, maybe I need a third one. I got halfway through the third one. I said, it doesn't work. That was my conclusion. I put the thing down. I turned around, like getting ready to leave. And I looked back in the room. And those 30 mean guys were gone, and they had been replaced by 30 of the friendliest guys I've ever seen. Everyone, I looked at their eyes, and everyone in that room wanted to know me. They were going, please join our group, please. We'd give anything for you to come over to our group. And I'm going, really? And I'm looking all around. I was in demand. And I started walking over to the first group, and on the way over, I had a little spring in my step. And I was giving it this, and I was going, they're right. They will be lucky to know me. I've only been drinking 8 minutes. it didn't change me. It changed the world that I lived in into a friendly, wonderful, awesome place. I was suddenly comfortable for the first time in my life, ever. I had never been comfortable like that. I never felt like, boy, am I glad to be alive. Isn't the world a wonderful place? Isn't life wonderful? You never heard me saying that till that night. And I said, life is nice. People, this is the greatest, the greatest. And I went around, talked to everybody. Boy, it was just like promises. I intuitively knew how to handle situations that used to baffle me. And I suddenly realized, whatever this alcohol does, it frees me to be me. All my creativity, all my ideas, they're all trapped inside of me when I'm sober because I'm afraid. Now I can be 100% me. It was almost like I had been set free to be me for the first time ever. And I just thought it was the greatest. And I said, well, if 3 drinks did it, what would 25 drinks do? And of course, you drink that much on your first night and you are sick. I'm deathly ill. I can't describe how awful you all went through it. And I woke up the next morning dying. I'm lying on the cold tile in the bathroom, right next to the toilet, up, down, you know, the whole routine. And after I stopped dry heaving, all that, I got back on my bed and I was sitting there with my head between my hands. And the thought occurred to me, are you going to drink again tonight? That fast. Of course I am. This near-death experience this morning is a very small price to pay for what I had last night. So I was ready to make the deal with the devil, and I haven't been drinking a full day yet. So I'm an alcoholic because alcohol did something for me that it doesn't do for non-alcoholics. It made me think I should have been drinking in grammar school. I said, this is the secret of life. As long as you've got a little alcohol in you, it is great. Now, if it was a movie and they would have the voice come down and go, son, before we let you go on any further, we got to have some understandings here. We're going to give you the full warning about what's happening. Would you be willing to give up your high grades for that feeling? Yes. Well, what about athletics? Oh, yeah, yeah, the hell with athletics. I'll be glad to give that up. Would you like to get in fights, get your teeth knocked out, get arrested? Yeah, I could handle that. That'll be all right. I could handle that. And, you know, go right through the whole thing. How about your family, all your friends? How about your soul? Okay, yeah, I'll give that up. That drinking is, it's worth it. It's worth it. So I made a decision in the first day that I was drinking that I would go to any length to have alcohol available to me because it was that important. It was that powerful. And that's why I was willing to throw up blood and do all this. And non-alcoholics look at us like we're crazy. How could you go through all that? And the reason is they don't get from alcohol what we got. So they don't understand why we would sacrifice that much. We got a world-transforming experience, much like the spiritual awakening is in sobriety. It's that powerful. And you're willing to kill or die for it. So now the rest of my story is simply the unfolding of the basic plot, which is you're going to be taken down by alcohol. Now, I thought I was just a social drinker like the other students. I barely graduated. The Korean War was going on. The draft was there. You had to join the military. I joined the Marine Corps with a bunch of other guys. When I first got there, I said, oh, my God, I made a terrible mistake. You know, they're very intense. But I made it through, and then I felt healthy, and you couldn't get access to booze. And after a while, I started really liking the discipline, I got brainwashed good, and I loved it. So it took 6 months, and then I'm a platoon leader, and during the classes, they showed a training movie about pilots. I've never been in a plane, never been near an airplane. But the pilots were at the bar in the training movie, and they were talking with their hands, and they had white scarves on, and there were some women standing in the background. Ooh. And it got my curiosity, and I went up to the major, and I said, what is the pilot thing there? And he said, oh, you don't want that. You have to sign up for 3 more years. I said, I could sign up for 3 more years. I might. Something about that looks appealing. Yeah, you're not sleeping in a foxhole. And so I signed up for it, never having been in a plane, and I made it through all the tests and the physical and all that, and I got married at the graduation, and I'm on my way to Pensacola to go through, become a naval aviator, Marine Corps aviator. Well, the problem was that on the way in the DC-3 out of New York to Atlanta, I got airsick. On the Atlanta to Pensacola, I got airsick. In the SNJ, first 6 flights, I'm barfing all over the plane. I have to clean it up. And my instructor's going, son, I don't think so. I don't think this is going to be you. But the motion sickness went away. And now I'm like second in my class. It was like I was born for this stuff. So I made it through. It took 18 months. You get to go through, do all the bombing and carrier and formation and that kind of stuff. And now I arrive in my first Marine fighter squadron. We go overseas, and it is the greatest. I just had the best time, and it's camaraderie. And we drank as a unit. We all show up at the end of the day and go to the bar, and we have our own table. And the drinks came in rounds. The colonel would go, give us a round. And there was, so you didn't order on your own. You just drank with the crowd. And they were drinking enough so that I was happy with the speed we were drinking. And it seemed like we all got drunk every night, and then we flew the next day, and it was just, I had the greatest time. And there about 8-9 months, and we were getting ready to practice to go aboard a carrier, and we're out on the field practice part of it, and this major, big Irish guy, he was the maintenance officer, and I were standing out in the end of the runway, watching, critiquing the other guys. And he started talking about, boy, when I make lieutenant colonel, I'm going to get my own fighter squadron. It's going to be the best squadron in the Marine Corps. Oh, it's going to be so exciting. And I'm going, yeah, yeah, Major, you're going to be the best. He said, I'm going to get nothing but the best pilots. And then I'm going, oh, yeah, yeah. And then he turned to me and he said, I want you in that squadron. Oh, boy, as a young first lieutenant, I was just taken. I just went, oh, my God. And then he said, but I wouldn't let you drink. And I'm going, what? What is that? We all get drunk every night. What is that? What is that? And it wasn't until I got to AA and I realized that alcoholic drinking stands out even in a big drinking crowd, if you follow what I'm saying. And he was looking at me going, look, we all get drunk every night. You take it up 2 levels above that. You're drinking with an intensity that scares me. You know what I mean? He saw something in my drinking, and this is early in my drinking career, that was scary to him. And so, but I didn't understand it, so I just went on my merry way, and we ended up having 6 kids. I had various duty assignments. I was back as a flight instructor, then I was a photo pilot and forward air control, did all these various things. But the main thing that was happening was alcohol was slowly taking over and over and over. And at the end, I would get in a plane. I was at Cherry Point, North Carolina. And I hadn't had a drink in 8 hours like they wanted you to, but I was in alcoholic withdrawals. And I would take off, and the withdrawals would get worse. I wouldn't be able to see the instrument panel. My hands were shaking. I was very confused and disoriented. And I was starting to get scared to fly with me. You know what I mean? It was like, hey, you're kind of dangerous. I don't think I'll go up with you. But you had to go. And so I'm flying and flying, and it's getting worse and worse, and it's just scaring the hell out of me. And I had a lot of close calls where I would hit the wrong switch or I'd touch something. And so I just knew that something bad was going to happen, but where are you going to go? You know what I mean? What are you going to do? Anyway, I had several things that were very scary. So I went to the doctor, and the doctor said, oh my God, he couldn't believe anybody was flying with these kind of things. Sent me back to Pensacola to study me for 2 weeks, but we had no alcohol. There was no disease of alcoholism. There were no alcohol programs. So you had to be diagnosed as something else. I know it sounds crazy now, but that's how it was in the early 60s. And so at the end of the 2 weeks, and they studied me, and of course I'm in there every day. I got drunk the night before. I'm in there. I'm reeking of alcohol, covered with clammy sweat. I'm very confused. My eyes are bloodshot, high blood pressure. You know, where am I? What's going on? And they can't figure out my problem is. So the psychiatrist diagnoses me as childhood fear of flying that just showed up after 14 years of flying. And I didn't have the guts or the anything to fight this. And so I just said, oh, okay, you know, give me a drink. And that was it. Well, I had a regular commission. I was making a career out of the Marine Corps, so they had to give me a new specialty. Everybody has to have a specialty. So I waited for 3 months. I get my orders from headquarters Marine Corps to be an air traffic controller. That shows you how crazy they were. And I made it through the school in Glencoe, Georgia, which is very hard. In my last year of drinking, I was in charge of an air traffic control unit in Japan, which brings planes in bad weather when they can't see the runway. So you can see that's what they did with this washed-up aviator. And I was very lucky because the senior enlisted men in that outfit could see what shape I was in. And they said, oh, Captain, good to have you here. Here's your tent. Here's your coffee thing. Sir, don't you personally go near the radar and control any planes. You just try to make it to work and have your coffee, and we'll do all the rest. And that's what I did for the year. And, of course, there was no 8 hours without drinking. I drank around the clock. I lost 50 pounds to malnutrition. I couldn't eat any solid food. I would drink vodka and juice, and I was trying to survive on juice. You know what I mean? I get all my vitamins and proteins from juice. So I was very, very sick and got sent back to Quantico to go to a career school. Now I'm hallucinating. I would get disoriented. I'd go to school, and then I couldn't find my way home. You know what I mean? And one day I came in the main gate at the Quantico Marine Base. I went up to the school, which is several large buildings, and they were gone. And I went, God damn, where did the buildings go? So I said, this is serious. So I'm going back to the main gate, and I'm going to report it to the guards. So I came back down, I went out the gate, and came right back around the other side, and they're watching me, and they're going, yes, sir? I said, Corporal, junior school is gone. And he said, sir? I said, junior school is gone. He said, what do you mean gone? I said, it's gone. I just went up there. It's gone. He said, well, we'll go with you. So they got their car with the red light going, and we're going up to investigate the disappearance of the school. And when we got up there, it was back. And they looked at me, and that's what I said to them. I said, it's back. So that's one of those things. Wouldn't you love to hear their version of this story? Anyway, within a few weeks after that, I had a grand mal seizure, and I bit my tongue, and I'm down, and I'm in the ambulance, and I'm in the hospital, and they're trying to figure it out. What caused this seizure? Again, there's no such thing as alcoholism. What is it? Oh, maybe he's studying too hard. I mean, it's really amazing to watch the rigmarole. But on about the seventh day without alcohol, I went in the DTs, the delirium tremens, and the stuff I saw scared me to death. The CIA was trying to break me with memory tests, and they were doing all this stuff, and I was going to disappear forever. And so I was freaking out, and evidently I lost it totally, and they had to catch me and put me in a straitjacket, and then I was locked up for 6 months. So that was my bottom when I crashed in there, and it was very painful to come back to life and all that kind of stuff. And there was no AA. There was just the nut ward. And the local AA group talked the head psychiatrist into allowing them to bring a meeting in, probably right near as I was getting near the end. And that's how I went to the meeting. The corpsman said, all drunks fall in, right face, down the elevator, and we're there. And I liked it, but I didn't think I belonged. I didn't think I was an alcoholic after all of that. But once I was sent out as an outpatient, now I was going to go back to duty, and they sent me out as an outpatient. I could go home at night and weekends. And I started drinking again. And they told me if I ever had another drink, my career was over. And I said, man, they're going to catch me, because now I'm bringing vodka into the nut ward. And I said, they're going to catch me, so I'll join AA, and then I'll blame it all on AA. I think that's why I called. So I called on December 7th at Pearl Harbor Day, 1964. That's my anniversary. I called the intergroup, and they sent another Marine captain over. He was the only other Marine in AA, and he came to my house. He bundled me up and took me to a meeting, and I haven't had a drink since. I wasn't planning on getting sober. Oh, thanks. And I've had the same sponsor for 40 years, which is a pretty nice thing. Number one, you both have to stay sober, and number two, you both have to stay alive. I mean, you know. So the journey in sobriety is what I'd like to talk about for the few minutes, 20 minutes that I got left. And, you know, what does it mean to me to have been given this journey? I find that my membership in Alcoholics Anonymous is 100 times, if not 1,000 times, more exciting than being in those fighter squadrons. That's how powerful AA is to me and what I've gotten out of it. It is that exciting. You see, when I first got here, I thought that all I was going to do is get sober. You know, that's what it looks like. Well, I'll have drinking out of my life. But that isn't it at all. There's so much more that has to happen. I remember when it started out, my sponsor said, look, you're going to have to give up drinking. I said, okay, I understand. AA program, you got to give up drinking. Okay, good. Then I've been going around a while, maybe a couple months, and he knew that whenever I was short of money, I would dip into the slush fund at work, which is embezzling. And he said, Sandy, I think you're going to have to stop embezzling, because that's going to get you in a lot of trouble. So I said, oh, let me understand this, Bill. If you're in AA, you have to give up drinking and embezzling. Is that what you're saying? And he said, yes. Okay, I can buy that. Okay, I'll give up two things. Another month went by, he says, Sandy, if you're going to hold your marriage together, you're going to have to give up having affairs. I said, so Bill, what you're telling me is if you're going to join AA, you have to give up three things, drinking, embezzling, and affairs. And he said, yeah, that's it. He had something every month. It was the get rid of something of the month. You got to stop gossiping. You got to stop this. You got to give up that. You got to give up this. You got to give up. And it was like, what? And I realized that what I was doing is getting rid of all the things, and from a spiritual sense, that I'm not. That isn't who I wanted to be, and that's who I'm not. That's not who I am on the inside. On the inside, I was a very caring and loving and nice person. I just had learned different ways of behaving in opposition to who I really was. I used to hate cheating. I used to hate all these things I was doing, but I did them anyway. There was some kind of a survival thing. There was part of me that didn't like what I was doing, but was powerless over doing anything about it. And it's a funny thing how powerful that other part of us is. This is a short little story about alcoholism, the disease. You know, it's not what the alcohol does. It's after the alcohol's out of our system that the disease really kills us. because it talks us into going back. If it didn't do that, we wouldn't even need the program. We're powerless over alcohol when we're sober, and we know all about alcoholism. We still will find a day when we have no defense against the first drink. And, you know, when you come up to rock concerts, a lot of times they got the guards out there, and you can't get in until you got the right pass and everything like that. And then, or if you're going to a nightclub and they got the guards out front, and, you know, and their job is to make sure that only the right people get in. And I call my ego my guard. And it decides who gets let in and who doesn't get let in. And this is in sobriety. You know, it's hard to get rid of your ego. Some time ago, I had the flu. Felt terrible. You know how the flu is. Made it through the vomiting days and all that. And I'm starting to just recover a little bit, but I'm so weak that I'm just not walking too well or looking well. But I'm starting to come out of it. And I was getting my mail, and one of the women that lives in my building said, God, you look awful. What's the matter? And I said, I had the flu. I've just been so sick. I feel awful. And she said, well, you know, I have a very special recipe for chicken soup. It has all the vegetables and the meat and all the nutrients and everything that your body needs right now. And I could have it ready and nothing flat, and I'll bring it over for you. And the guard at my door, my ego, said, no thanks, I don't need any chicken soup. I'm doing fine on my own. Don't bother with the soup. Don't want the soup. Thank you, but we don't want any soup. And I went home, and the rest of me said, how come we never get any soup? We love soup. Soup would make us feel great. How come you never let any help in here? I'm going to call her myself and tell her that I want some soup. And my ego said, hey, do you want to look bad? Do you want to look weak? You don't need any help. Only weak people need help. I don't care. I'm going to call her up and get the chicken soup. I don't care if I look bad. Do you want me to tell her who you really are? Do you want me to tell her all the bad things you've done? You don't deserve chicken soup down there. Now shut up. And in early sobriety, the guard would win. And I'd go, yeah, you're right. I'm not going to call her. And I'd sit there wanting the chicken soup. God, I wish that chicken soup was there. But I'll be damned if I'm going to let it in. Because I don't deserve it. And what if she did find out who I was with all my secrets? But there came a day when I finally said to the ego, I'm calling her anyway. The hell with you. I want chicken soup. And the ego said, we're going to let her know every secret thing you've done if you do that. I said, I don't care. I'm calling her up anyway. So I called the lady up. And I said, this is Sandy. I want the chicken soup after all. I've changed my mind. I want the chicken soup. Will you bring the chicken soup over? And she said, yeah, I'd be glad to bring the chicken soup over. And then I said, but there's one thing I want to ask you first. So will you bring the chicken soup over, even if it's for a very flawed person? She said, I specialize in bringing chicken soup to very flawed people. And that's sobriety. So if you're new, ask for the chicken soup. You understand what I'm saying? Stop saying no to yourself. Because the doorman says you're not worth it, and you don't want to look weak, and you don't want to ask for help, and you don't want to do any of these things. Stand up against yourself and say, I'm ordering the chicken soup. Get the hell out of here. I'm in charge now. And then take over your own life there. So overcoming the resistance to asking for help is what sobriety is all about. We just don't like to ask for help. And guess what the whole program is? What does it say? Turn our will and our lives over the care of God. And then we get all the way to the 11th step, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry it out. I was at a discussion meeting this morning. Was I there this morning? Yes, today's Saturday. Yeah, I was at a Saturday morning. And I made the observation that if we followed the 12 steps exactly as they're written, absolutely literal, the meetings would be very boring, terribly boring. Now, what do I mean by that? This is what I mean. No matter what problem was brought up, you would just hear this. Well, I lost my job, and I've got a very bad health problem. So I'm going to ask God to remove my anxiety over it. I'm going to ask him to guide me wherever I should go, and I'm going to ask him for the power to do it. Thank you very much. Next. Well, my mother's dying, and my sister just had a head-on collision and may not live. And so I'm going to ask God to remove all my anxiety about this, and I'm going to ask him for guidance as to what I should do, and I'm going to ask him for the power to carry it out. Okay, next. Yes. And then all the way around the room, that's all anybody would ever say. Now, the problem with that is it leaves our ego sitting in the background. Hey, what? Is God going to solve everything? Hey, I'm no dummy, you know. I can think up better stuff than God. And as a result of our ego, the meetings are interesting. Because, well, my mother's dying and my sister had a head-on collision in the car, and this is what I'm going to do. I've decided, and I'm going to, and I think, and I'm going to, and I'm going to. Notice I did not involve God. So that's a non-AA solution, but at least it's not boring. I'm just poking fun at all of us, that you understand what I'm saying, that we still want to figure things out ourselves, and we don't. Oh, God, I understand you're available to help. Not this time, baby. I'm doing it on my own. And it's that same old problem of wanting to be self-sufficient. Now, I've been here 40 years. And when you're brand new, you totally rely on the program for everything. And if you work the program correctly, when you have 40 years, you're going to rely on it much more than when you were a newcomer. Now, that sounds opposite of anything else. Anywhere else, you get stronger and wiser and more capable, and you finally take over yourself. But not in the spiritual program. You try to find more things to turn over to your higher power so that life becomes less and less and less of a burden. It's just not your job to be messing around with your life. Chuck Chamberlain from the West Coast, one of my heroes, he passed away, I guess, about 10 years ago, maybe longer. But they got tapes back there, and then that new pair of glasses was the transcription of a retreat that he did. And he always used to say this, it'd drive me crazy. He'd go, now let's get this straight. It's not your job to take care of yourself. That's God's job. Your job is to do God's work. And I go, Chuck, wait. You don't really mean that, do you? And I would go up and talk to him after the meeting. I said, Chuck, it's not my job to take care of myself. He says, no, why are you doing that? Who told you to take care of yourself? That's God's job. You just do God's work. You'll be taken care of. And you know what that is? It's true. And you will find, as you're in the program, that you're going to turn more and more things over, and they're going to be better taken care of than with you in charge. Guy Kay goes to the group that I go to, a wonderful, great guy, and he always talks about God has a better plan than anything you could ever dream up. And so if you want the very best for yourself, stop trying to figure it out yourself. This is the paradoxes of coming into the spiritual side. We start out by winning by surrendering. If you want to get spiritual, it's not a very complicated thing. If you're new and you're having a hard time with the spiritual part of the program, there's only one part of the program, the spiritual part. There are no other parts. This whole thing is a spiritual program. It's teaching us to let go of the world and the rules that we operate in the material world and come over into the spiritual world. And this is our dilemma, is that we live in both places at the same time. We're human beings and we're spiritual beings. But the idea is to make the transition. And so I tell new people, if you want to get spiritual, it's real simple. You go home, you get a white flag, a white handkerchief out, and you just wave it over your head. That's the sign of unconditional surrender. And then from now on, you only have one question that you ever ask. What am I supposed to do next? You don't figure out what you're supposed to do next. You ask. In the beginning, we ask our sponsor, our home group. To this day, I run everything by other people. I don't care what it is. I'll be at work or now I'm retired. I'll run into some situation at a condo meeting or something like that. I get freaked out over something. I'm a little upset. I just go right to the phone. Hello, Dan. You got 2 seconds? Let me run something by you. I'm at the meeting. The guy said this. I did that. I did that. How do you see it? And he says, well, from where I'm seeing, you owe the guy an amend. Really? It doesn't look like that from here. Well, trust me, it is. Okay, run back. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. I was out of line. Okay, I called him up the next time. He said, whoa, boy, from where I sit, that guy is completely out of line. That was totally uncalled for and absolutely ridiculous. So forgive him. Now, why would we do all this? Because the incident happened and it disturbed us. The top priority is, let's get undisturbed. Let's not get even. Let's not get revenge. Let's get undisturbed. As soon as you get undisturbed, you don't need revenge. It's a non-event. Because whenever we're disturbed, we have cut ourselves off from our higher power. We are now operating on our own. It's you against the world. And part of the reason we drank was the world overpowered us. It was too much. How many times have you said, it's too much for me? Is it too much for me? Well, why don't you have God help you? Oh, the hell with him. It's too much for me. It's too much for me. I like doing things on my own. I don't like dragging him in. He's probably busy. You know, all of that. Now, here we have infinite power plus your little bit. And there's nothing that can overpower that. And so this is teaching us to stay undisturbed. And then we will intuitively know. All the promises will come in. I'm getting right down to the last 5 minutes. And I guess what I wanted to talk about were the promises. I'm not going to tell you the promise. I'm not going to recite the promises. I'm going to ask you to look at the verbs in the promises. Maybe you've never done that before. Because at the end of those promises, now if you read the preceding thing, it's talking about how powerful the program is. But if we didn't have that there, and you read those promises to somebody on the outside, and you asked them, do you think these are a little extravagant? They would say, yes. This is unbelievable what those things are doing. I understand, sir, that you have a problem with self-seeking. Is that right? Oh, yeah, I just think about myself all the time. Well, don't worry, it's going to slip away. What? What is that? It's going to slip away. It's going to slip away like it's gone. It just slips away. That's what a spiritual solution looks like. Whew. Problems go. They don't get solved. They get removed. Fear of people and economic insecurity. Oh, I got that. I'm going to have to get a lot of money and take some psychology courses in adjusting to people. Oh, no, no. You work these stupid 12 steps. And fear of people and economic insecurity will leave you. Oh, leave me? Yeah, it gets tired of you and it leaves and it goes over to be with somebody else. You mean it just leaves me? Yeah. And you could look at each one of them. These are verbs that are not used when you solve something. They're not psychological verbs. They're not overcoming verbs. They are spiritual verbs. And then at the end, we suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. You don't think that's extravagant? I think it is. It's absolutely. But when you consider the power, the higher power and all the power there, it's not extravagant at all. It's very routine. So in AA, we see miracles on such a steady basis that we sometimes forget it's a miracle. We just go, oh yeah, Mary Jane came in about 6 months ago, just ready to commit suicide. Her kids wouldn't talk to her, and there was no chance of her keeping her job. She just got promoted, her kids love her, and she thinks life is wonderful. And you just go, oh, of course, she joined AA, and that's what happens at the meetings, and it's just another one of those things. This is our visual proof of the existence of a higher power. It is so apparent if we take the time to look for it. The end of chapter 5 said, God could and would if he were sought. You remember that thing, the thing we read every time? God could and would if he were sought. I used to think it said God could and would. You know, they read it real fast. You know, well, going to return us to sanity. We're alcoholic, couldn't manage our own lives. No human power could have relieved our alcoholism. God could and would. And I said, yeah, could and would. But what's it's got in there? It says, if he were sought. Sought. What is sought? And here's my 2 cents worth on sought, and then I'll stop. First time I ever heard the word sought or seek was in grammar school. And they said, kids, here's the new game, hide and seek. Oh, really? How does that go? Okay, Mary's going to go hide. Shut your eyes. Then when she's ready, I'll say, go seek her. Oh, seek is like looking. You go try and find her. So she'd go hide, and then we'd start looking. And remember how intense you would look? Yeah. But if you didn't find her in about 2 minutes, yeah. Boring. Where are you? You kind of lose interest, you know what I mean, in the game. So that's a very low level of seeking. Now, the next level that I remember was Easter. And my mother would hide 2.5 pounds of solid chocolate. And I had a great interest in that as a young kid. Not anymore. And she said, I'm going to hide this, and if you find it, it's yours. Well, the level of seeking here was much higher. I would go maybe 15 minutes before I got tired. You know what I'm saying? Going, how many places are there? Down in the basement. You remember all that stuff? And then you'd go, am I warm? And you were trying to get a clue because it's hard to maintain that intensity of seeking for 2.5 pounds of chocolate. Now, the next level of seeking, we had a golden retriever. And this dog was mine. I mean, the other family members thought he was his, but I knew he was mine. And one day I came home from school, and I asked where he was, and my mother said he ran away. And I said, where'd he go? And she said, I don't know. Last I saw him, he went into those woods over there. Now, I went after that dog. I was out there in the dark calling his name. We're at a new level of seeking. I mean, I am seeking that dog. And then I'm back the next day, and I'm back the next day. And I looked till I left New Haven. I must have looked for 3 years. I knew he was gone, but every time I came there, I would still look in there. I'd go over and call his name. You know, maybe he could still be in there. He could, who knows? Then I could come back 10 years later, and I'd still drive by those woods, and I'd go, he could still be there. Now that's seeking. You know what I'm talking about? You really want to find him. Have we ever taken our seeking for God to that level? Why not? This is the ultimate thing to find. This is the point of the AA program, is to finally, on page 25, it said the central fact of this entire, the central fact of this entire program is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered our hearts and lives there in a most beautiful way. I think that's worth it. That is what is at stake. Sure, there's all the 12 stepping and there's all this, oh, and it's just wonderful. But the personal thing that is here is to have your hand reaching out and finally making contact. That's called the jackpot. And it's available to all seekers. Hope you find them soon. Thank you all very much.